This is Holiday Readings and Remembrances, reflections on the season as told by members of the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. I'm Stan Wright. We begin this series with a return to one of the most requested holiday readings ever presented, A Rinkrat's Christmas by Northern Michigan University English professor and author John Smolens.
It was the night before Christmas, 1960-something. I was a high school junior, and I practiced the world's second oldest profession. I was a goalie. Officially, I was the goalie on our high school team. Unofficially, I was a rink rat, which means I was always looking for ice time. I grew up about a dozen miles from Boston Garden, and I knew every rink and arena from Billerica to Norwood. After supper, I got a phone call from Fred Duvall. Fred worked for the town. He supervised the men who plowed snow, repaired potholes, and collected trash, but his avocation was organizing pickup hockey games at odd hours of the night. I received such calls often, as did my younger brothers Peter and Michael, because they too were goalies. In our hometown, there was a good decade where our phone number was on a lot of refrigerators in a lot of hockey households. Need a goalie? You called the Smolens boys. By the time I was 8, all I wanted to be was a goalie. This was before the term role model even existed, and my sports heroes were the great NHL goaltenders such as Jacques Plante, Glenn Hall, and Terry Sawchuk. I was enamored of the big leather pads, gloves, and sticks. And once my folks popped for the equipment, it made sense to hand the pads down to the other boys. It's often said that you have to be crazy to be a goalie. A family of them constitutes a DNA mutation science has yet to crack, and ours was saved only by the fact that our sister Beth got to ride horses on Saturday afternoons wearing jodhpurs and a black felt helmet, all of which may be the reason for her inordinately sunny disposition. Fred had a supervisor's telephone voice, and he wasn't accustomed to taking no for an answer. So I agreed to fill in at a pickup game he had organized later that night. Even though it was Christmas Eve, there was no place I'd rather be than a hockey rink. Besides, Fred's bunch was on the other side of the moon from the boys I usually played with. We had ice in Melrose, a town just north of Boston, from 10 to 12. So you'll have time, he said, to make it to midnight mass. I borrowed my mother's car, a 1963 Dodge Dart, the ones that had the push-button automatic transmission, and drove to Melrose. All hockey rinks, by definition, are smelly, cold, run-down places, but the Rosie, as it was called, was in a class by itself. It was in a building that used to be a bus terminal. The lighting was bad and the ice slushy. But what really set the Rosie apart was the fact that there was a post in the middle of the ice, a supporting steel column that for some reason had never been taken out when they turned the place into a skating rink. The column was just inside the blue line, about 8 feet from the boards, and everyone knew you don't skate near it. I arrived early in the locker room, a cinder block cube that cannot be accurately described on public radio. As I slowly donned 40 pounds of equipment, skates, leg pads, chest protector, shoulder and arm pads, and the enormous gloves, other players began to wander into the locker room. I had played enough with this group to know that I would be the youngest among them. Some fellows looked as though they were perhaps a dozen seasons past skating for their high school teams, but a number of them were easily old enough to be my father. But something happens to a locker room full of guys in hockey gear. Age no longer matters. Or if it does, it morphs into the great equalizer. This bunch of 30, 40, and even 50-somethings were all miraculously turned into 14-year-olds, because at 14, all hockey players consider themselves immortal. These guys shouted, they sang, they screamed, emitting more testosterone than a pack of sled dogs. There were two reasons for such revelry. The first had to do with their names. Once they entered the rink, they were not who they were out there in the real world. I knew that I was surrounded by men who were supervisors, insurance agents, dentists, and carpet salesmen, and they had first names such as Ted and Bob and Jim. But here in the Rosie, everyone went by a nickname. Seated on the bench to my right was a stocky man with massive forearms called the Weasel. To my left was Scooter, a lawyer who'd played for Dartmouth. There was a milkman everyone called Choo Choo, who cruised around the ice puffing on a stogie. There were the Duval twins, Crash and Dynamite. My favorite was the rangy center, who always removed his front teeth before games and talked like this. It was known as Cuddles. Even Fred Duval was no longer Fred Duval once he laced up the blades. In the locker room, everyone called him Dad. It was Dad who collected the money to pay for the ice time, and after tallying up, he'd say, "Who's light? I'm shot $2. It wasn't me because goalies skate free. The other thing that made this Christmas Eve so festive was that everyone, except the goalie, had already been into the holiday cheer. As we stepped out onto the ice, it was clear that some of the guys were half in the bag, while others were thoroughly toasted. Obviously, they'd come from office parties or bars, the kind of neighborhood taverns where the Christmas decorations, which are kept up year-round, finally lend such tawdry establishments a few days of timely, genuine festivity. Playing hockey is like riding a bicycle. Once you learn to skate, pass, and shoot, you never really forget how. It's a sport played on a different medium, ice. During warm-ups, when everyone lined up at the blue line and took practice shots at me and the other goalie, who had been conscripted from a rival high school, it was clear that these guys all came to play. They let go quick, accurate wrist shots, fierce slap shots, and the few who still used a straight-bladed stick glided toward my net at an angle and deftly ripped off backhand shots. This was pickup hockey, no coaches, no clock, no referees, and quickly Dad divided everyone into two teams, and within minutes, play was on. Perhaps the most remarkable thing for me about this Christmas Eve tilt was the first 10 or 12 minutes. It was a rare thing of beauty. Fueled by pure instinct and adrenaline, not to mention Blue Ribbon and Johnny Walker, the quality of play was nearly flawless. To the uninitiated, who see hockey as merely a brutal street fight on frozen water, the grace and complexity of the game will forever be lost. But anyone who happened to be in the Rosie that night, anyone who'd spent a childhood playing pond hockey or listening to radio broadcasts of games between the Bruins and the Red Wings, would have immediately realized that they were in the presence of a true work of art. The passes were crisp. Everyone covered his man. Everybody forechecked and backchecked. Everybody skated his lane. I had lots of work and felt good and loose, and so did my counterpart down at the other end of the rink. In those first few minutes, only one goal was scored, when Dad cut across the blue line, dropped the puck to Choo Choo, who feathered a pass to Scooter as he busted for the net and tipped it home. In hockey parlance, the goal was click, click, bang. We were up 1-0. The beauty of the game was accompanied by music. The rink manager, a jovial fellow, who I'm sure had never seen the light of day, had taken it upon himself to play Christmas carols over the PA system, so that Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was playing as my teammates raised their sticks victoriously after the goal had been scored. But soon, that first rush of adrenaline gave way to sucking wind and wobbly legs. The beer and shots were clearly catching up with some of them. Nobody was connecting passes now, and play quickly turned ragtag. My defense ran around in our end. Nobody covered in front, and the weasel snapped a wrist shot over my right shoulder to tie the game 1-1. Play continued, though now it resembled chaos theory on ice. Worse, the soundtrack had an eerie way of dictating the tenor of the game. When the PA boomed, "I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus," the playmaking was perky but insecure. And then, to the little drummer boy, everyone skated to the cadence of "A Rump-a-Dump-Dump." Just when the game seemed in danger of grinding to a halt, there was a stirring on both benches. Players stood up and began slapping their sticks on the boards until the action on the ice came to a halt. It was difficult to see from my net because of the post out near my blue line, but everyone was looking down the dark corridor that went under the stands to the locker rooms. And then, as the first notes of Jingle Bell Rock drifted down upon us, a fat man in a red and white suit stepped out onto the ice. Cuddles grabbed his eyes with his gloves and shouted, "Thanacloth!" As St. Nick took a tentative warm-up lap around center ice, it was clear that he had stayed too long at too many Christmas parties. When the game resumed, Santa played center for the other team, and his presence invigorated both sides. Though the caliber of the game didn't return to the rare beauty we had witnessed early on, there were fleeting moments where it approached respectability. Furthermore, it was only a few minutes before the hour was up, and beyond the boards at the far end of the rink, the impatient Zamboni was growling to life. The other team's game plan was obvious: give the puck to Santa. The problem was, Santa didn't have what we call soft hands, and he couldn't keep a pass on his stick. But they kept feeding him passes, and to cheers from both benches, he finally had the puck in some daylight at center ice. And then, as Bing Crosby began crooning White Christmas, a strange thing happened. A miracle, if you will. Santa slowly but deftly eluded two of our forwards, and then he neatly faked left and went right, avoiding Dad's poke check. Everyone was hollering as Santa came down toward my defenseman, Dynamite, and Crash. All night long, the play in my end of the rink had avoided the post in the ice. But now, Santa crossed the blue line, used the post in something of a pick-and-roll move, which caused Crash to collide with the steel beam and slump to the ice in overly dramatic fashion. I realized then that this was all a setup. Only one defender remained between Santa and me, Dynamite, who was clearly not the brightest light in the scoreboard. As Santa cruised out from behind the post, Dynamite stepped up and did the one thing he did well. He turned neatly and threw a hip check, sending Santa into the air. But in a nifty move, Santa came down on the ice, genuflected on one knee to regain his balance, and sped toward my net. Players on both teams were hollering now. Santa Claus had a breakaway. And there, in the split second that I shuttled out to the top of my goal crease, I was suddenly confronted with the deep ethical question no honest goaltender should ever have to face. It was Christmas Eve, and I was supposed to let Santa Claus score the winning goal. I thought of one of my goaltending heroes, Terry Sawchuk. Season after season, he donned the pads and lived by the goaltender's creed: you do anything to keep the puck out of your net. But here came Santa Claus, swooping in through the face-off circle to my left. He dribbled the puck with considerable deliberation, and though he was no Guy Lafleur, he skated fast enough to press his full white beard flat against his chest. Santa Claus was going to attempt to fake me out with a deke. Now, goaltenders develop a number of moves called saves. Two of the most athletic saves are the split and the butterfly. But the most difficult save, the move that is reserved for the most desperate moment, is the sprawl. The sprawl resembles a baseball player sliding into home plate, except that the idea is to stack both goalie pads on the ice so that there is no way that the puck can get under you and into the net. It's a move that requires impeccable timing and takes years to perfect. I was 16, agile and limber, and I could throw a good sprawl. It was the card I dealt in many breakaway situations. And indeed, Santa did go through a couple of fakes as he glided across the goal mouth. He threw his head left, jingling the bell atop his floppy hat, and then he shifted his shoulders right, which really had the effect of causing his enormous belly to swing dangerously over one hip. As he released the backhand shot, I sprawled, stacking my pads, my skate blades ringing off the far goalpost. Then Santa stopped, his blades sending up ice chips, which floated down on my face mask, light and cool as the first snow of winter. There was silence from both benches, and White Christmas mercifully had come to an end. Slowly, Santa raised his stick above his head and let out a hearty ho, ho, ho. Santa had scored the winning goal, and everyone in the Rosie went nuts. The locker room afterwards was truly festive. Guys wiped snow and ice off their blades and bombarded each other. No one was bothered by the fact that we had lost, and for once, no one blamed the goalie. As I left the rink, it was beginning to snow. Lovely flakes the size of Kennedy half dollars. While driving home, I wondered if I had hesitated, if only for a split second, if I had intentionally sprawled across the goal crease a moment too late, allowing Santa to slip the puck under me and into the net. I wondered if I had done the one thing Terry Sawchuk would never do. The more I thought about it, the more I played the moment over in my mind, the more I realized I simply didn't know. And I'm still not sure. I probably never will know if I gave one up to Santa Claus. I do know that despite rather heavy snow, I made it home in time to attend midnight mass with my family. And that afterwards, as was always our tradition, my brothers and sister and I were allowed to sit around the Christmas tree and open one present, just one, before going to bed. Something about that Christmas Eve ritual made that one present special, but I don't even recall what I got that year. It isn't important. But I think that that was the year I came to realize the true value of gifts, of receiving them, and of giving them.
Holiday Readings and Remembrances is a Public Radio 90 production produced at the WNMU-FM studios in the Learning Resources Center on the campus of Northern Michigan University. I'm your producer and host, Stan Wright. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.